Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the shifting political sands as the Arab Spring sweeps the Middle East. Vali Nasser, who was until recently the senior advisor to President Obama's envoy to Pakistan and Afghanistan, joins us. Although the revolution of hope has tyrants toppling, Vali Nasser warns the Arab Spring could turn ugly as cornered despots resort to stirring up sectarian strife. Then we'll examine the political record of an emerging favorite amongst Republicans and some progressives, Ron Paul. Alternate's Washington editor Adele Stan joins us to explain why, if you're a member of an anti-woman, anti-gay, anti-black, anti-senior citizen, anti-equality, anti-education, pro-communist witch hunt wing of the progressive movement, then Ron Paul's your guy. Then finally, we will have a conversation with historian Michael Kazin about American Dreamers, his new book, which at a time when the American right is in ascendancy, provides a refreshing history of the American left that transformed both American society and the American soul, but since FDR has had a dismal record of progress in terms of political, social, and economic achievements. Let's now turn to the Middle East and the shifting sands as the Arab Spring brings forth hope, but our next guest suggests that it could also turn ugly. Joining us now is Vali Nasser, who's a professor of international politics at Tufts University. He was born in Iran and migrated with his family to the United States following the 1979 Islamic Revolution. His books include The Rise of Islamic Capitalism, Forces of Fortune, The Rise of a New Muslim Middle Class and What It Will Mean for Our World, The Shia Revival and Democracy in Iran. Between 2009 and 2011, he served in the Obama administration as senior advisor to the special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. Welcome to Background Briefing, Vali Nasser.
Thank you.
And clearly, if you look at what's happening recently with conflicting signals from the Iranian regime and from Hezbollah, it would seem that something is happening with Syria's biggest sponsor, which is Iran, having, I think, put up about $7 billion to keep the Assads in power. They've sent in the Revolutionary Guard Corps, al-Quds, to crack down on the Syrian opposition. But what gives here when the Iranian foreign minister is saying, well, maybe the Assads should talk to their people rather than crack heads and murder them? Does that say more about divisions within the Iran ruling elite, or is there a change of heart on the part of Iran and Hezbollah?
No, I don't think it says either one. It actually points to the fact that Iran understands that the Assad regime's tactics are not popular in the Arab world, and that the mood of the Arab world is not supportive of dictatorship and crackdowns and wants reform in Syria. And therefore, the Iranians understand that their very close support for the Assad regime is isolating them in the Arab world, and they are trying to distance themselves from being seen as being unequivocally supportive of a crackdown. So at the same time as they're supporting the Assad regime, they're also encouraging it to listen to its public. But that's more of a public relations statement, which is neither here nor there. It is directed not at the at the Assad government, but really at the Arab public.
So do you think the Arab public has such a short memory that they don't remember that the Arab Spring arguably began in Iran with the Green Movement that was brutally quashed by this very same regime in Tehran?
Well, they are hoping so. They are hoping that the Arab public will not be focused on Iran, but rather will be focused on developments in the Arab world. And Syria essentially is a very big challenge for Iran, because it's a case in which Iran's interest puts it at odds with the Arab public. It wants the Assad regime to survive. It wants it to get past this crisis. It wants the uprising in Syria to go away. But in the meantime, while the Assad government is busy killing people, the Iranian government finds itself increasingly at odds with the public opinion in the Arab world, and that's not a comfortable place for it.
So is there, given that some time back the Jordanian king warned about the Shiite crescent, because arguably the winner of the Iraq war was Iran, and you can tell by statements from Maliki recently in support of Syria where he stands, but it does seem that Iran is perhaps poised for a major setback there. Isn't it reasonable to assume that eventually the Assads will go?
Well, it is quite possible that there will be a profound change in the character of Syria. How soon this will happen, and in what manner this is going to happen, is still open to question. This could potentially take a year or two. It could end up with either a military coup at the top, or with the collapse of the regime, or ultimately, in the worst case scenario, with some kind of a civil war or civil conflict. And each of those will have its own impact. Governments around Syria, Iraq, Turkey are very worried about this outcome. So is Lebanon. And the Iranian also feel that the longer this protracted conflict goes on in Syria, the more Iran stands to lose.
Again, I'm speaking with Vali Nasser, who is a professor at Tufts University. He served as senior advisor to the Obama administration, special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. In the article you wrote in Sunday's New York Times opinion section, If the Arab Spring Turns Ugly, you mention that already on the border between Iraq and Syria, there is tensions. And I take it there's a possibility, given the nature of that part of the world and the recent warfare there, that there's a possibility of a lot of weapons flowing from the Anbar Sunni part of Iraq into the Brotherhood, or whatever you choose to describe the Sunni majority.
Yes, and also, you know, there's all kinds of reports that the price of weapons on the Lebanese market has been going steadily up, and most of it is going in the direction of Syria. And also many in the Syrian opposition, particularly more on the extremist fringes of it, are looking at what happened in Libya and are arguing that, you know, in Libya, ultimately the opposition took up guns and resisted and challenged the Gaddafi regime militarily, and that potentially the opposition in Syria ought to do the same. But given the fact that the regime is using a very clear sectarian tact in its suppression of the protesters, that this may also end up taking a sectarian reaction. Even in Libya, you know, once the military resistance started, the tribal divisions in the country, the divisions between East and the West, between Benghazi and Tripoli, all of it came into play. And in Syria, when similar kinds of divisions come into play in any kind of a military challenge to the Assad regime, it will include not just tribal elements, but also sectarian divisions.
But Vali Nasser, aren't we dealing with something new here, in the sense that it's a pretty dismal choice between if you're a Syrian, and by the way, these people are incredibly brave in this nonviolent struggle, facing the military equipment of this vast killing machine led by the Alawite generals, and mostly the brother of Assad, Maha. But the choice is, if the choice is between Saudi Arabia, who's now condemning the Syrian regime, even though they are not famous for their human rights, and the Al-Quds, IRGC, Basij, you know, the clique that runs Iran at the moment, it's a pretty dismal choice. But isn't there something else going on here that goes all the way across the Middle East, from Tunisia through Egypt, and even in Israel now, the young people seem to be fed up with these regimes that as I think the refrain is, we want dignity. They're stealing our future.
Absolutely. I mean, this whole political upheaval in the region has started by populations refusing to accept things as they are, asking for accountability, asking for integrity, asking for a representative government, and more economic opportunity and better distribution of wealth in these societies. But the result of the of this popular challenge to these governments in the Arab world is to weaken the political structures that have also kept other kinds of conflicts in place. So, you know, in Syria, you have a minority that has enjoyed enormous amount of power and the better share of the wealth. The regime that protected this kind of a relationship is now teetering on the verge of collapse. And therefore, one of the things that has to be sorted out in the post-Assad regime is that the Alawites would lose resources, power, position to the majority population. And as we saw also in Iraq and we see in other cases, we saw in Bahrain, many the minorities that benefit from these regimes, even if they are unhappy about the regime behavior, are nevertheless they're not happy about losing their existing position and taking a back seat to the future. So, you know, the dynamic we have in this region right now is that the people and the people's movement and people's power is challenging the social and political structures that have been in place for decades. But those structures don't come undone easily. There is not always a soft landing. There are conflicts that have to be settled before you get to a much more peaceful and stable scenario. And that's exactly the dilemma in Syria.
But overlaying this whole area, which is what you've done in your Sunday article of Ali Nasser, where you have charts and graphs that show the Shiite Sunni division in all of these countries and the ratio of, in terms of population. Let's go through then the most likely fault lines, because there are many. Where things could turn into kind of sectarian strife, either spontaneously or as a result of the manipulation by cornered despots. Let's start with Lebanon, which has a Shiite majority, but the Hezbollah's some Hezbollah operatives have been just indicted by the UN trial into the murder of Hariri, of course, the prime minister, who was both a Sunni and a Saudi citizens, along with being the president of Lebanon.
Mm-hmm. Well, exactly. I mean, you know, the problematic of Lebanon is that it already had a simmering sectarian tension that started even before the Arab Spring. You've had, ever since the murder of Prime Minister Hariri in 2005, you've had this ongoing accusation that the country's largest Shia organization is responsible for murder of a popular Sunni prime minister. And then now you have the United Nations Tribunal, as of June of this year, formally indict Hezbollah members in the murder. And Hariri's murder and the subsequent clashes in Lebanon, the UN indictment, they all have polarized the politics of that country along those who support Hezbollah and its position, and those who are opposed to Hezbollah and believe that it has to be held accountable for Hariri's murder. Now, this division very neatly, by and large neatly, falls along a Sunni-Christian alliance vis-a-vis a Shia one. Now, many have viewed the Syrian regime as a critical piece of an Iran-Hezbollah alliance that is playing itself out in Lebanon. Now, that critical link is now under pressure because of the uprising in Syria, and at the same time that uprising is also pitting the Sunni majority in Syria against the Alawi minority. So, you know, Lebanon is both vulnerable to what's happening in Syria by the example of a Sunni Alawite clash, as well as the very fact that because of the very closeness of Syria to Lebanon, both geographically and politically, that it can very easily spill over into Lebanon. So, you know, you have the similar kinds of sectarian divisions. The one in Lebanon has been ongoing. It predates what happened in Syria. And what is happening in Syria may very well sort of be the straw that breaks the camel's back and forces a resolution to this standoff in Lebanon.
But could it also reignite the sectarian divide in Iraq? Because the Sunni, as we mentioned earlier, in the West, in Anbar, are supporting the Sunni majority who are being murdered by the Alawite regime in Syria, and yet their new government, which is heavily allied with Iran, is supporting the Assads.
It's quite possible. In other words, because across this region you have unresolved tensions between Shiites and Sunnis and a disgruntlement about the existing distribution of wealth and power, when you have a flashpoint in one country, it very easily can become an example for populations in other countries, and then therefore the conflict would begin to travel. There's also an issue of narratives. You see, the narrative of the Arab Spring is generally a narrative of democracy versus dictatorship, people's power versus political elites, accountability, integrity. The narrative that the Syrian government is trying to push is one of competition of power between minorities and majorities. And if this narrative in Syria begins to play out much more prominently, it would become a competitive narrative elsewhere also with the narrative of the Arab Spring. This is what we saw during the Iraq War, that the narrative that the United States had in mind, which is one of establishment of democracy in Iraq, was very quickly overwhelmed by the narrative of sectarian conflict. So there is an underlying tension in this region because of the unresolved sectarian issues that potentially, if you have a flare-up in one country, it could put on the table a very powerful narrative that then would begin to play itself out in other places. If Syria, for instance, begins to produce a very clear-cut conflict between Shiites and Sunnis, you're going to have populations across the Arab world take sides. So, you know, where would the Sunnis in the Gulf and Shiites in the Gulf, Sunnis in Iraq, Sunnis in Shiites in Iraq, whose side they would take, Sunnis in Lebanon, Shiites in Lebanon. So therefore, it has a potential to bring to the fore a very different narrative than the one that we're seeing, and if that and that's a big if, but if that comes to pass, then it could augur additional political tensions and conflicts in other places.
And of course, these conflicts go on all the time. They go on in Pakistan, where you have about a 15% minority of Shiites. They recently erupted in Bahrain, where Saudis helped suppress the Shiite majority. But you warn that could be radicalized now because they're being more repressed. And even within Saudi Arabia, where you've only got 15% minority of Shiites, you also have, I think, a kind of nascent Arab Spring there. And the Saudi regime is desperately trying to buy off the younger generation, but to buy off the younger generation, that means the price of oil has to stay high, right?
That's all true. I mean, in each of these countries, this conflict can take very different forms. I mean, in Pakistan, it's a sort of a state of bombing attacks and assassinations and kidnappings. In Bahrain, it took the form of massive street protests during that country's Arab Spring uprising. In Iraq, a lot of it is now taking the form of either bombing campaigns that are still ongoing, as well as a paralysis in the Iraqi parliament. And in Lebanon, we also see it right now reflected in the political paralysis in the country, but that can change and it can take a more violent tone. So, you know, in other words, in each of these countries, this is an evolving picture. It may take a different form in terms of how this will play out. And in the Gulf, it is true that the oil wealth helped douse enthusiasm for the Arab Spring, but also important was the specter of sectarian conflict. So, you know, when Bahrain erupted in a popular uprising, it was very clear that if it would have succeeded, that you would have had a diminishment of Sunni power in that country and empowerment of the Shias. And probably many in Saudi Arabia decided that they don't want to see that, and that reduced their enthusiasm for pushing for many more political reforms. So you know, you already had the sectarianism playing as a competitive narrative in the Gulf to that of the Arab Spring.
Well, just in closing here, Vali Nasser, it feels to me that the whole area is kind of booby-trapped in a way, on a precipice, and you've got this new force of demanding freedom and liberation coming from a younger generation who are not going to be satisfied with the old ways. So what's your final conclusion here?
No, I think what the young people are asking is very hopeful and is very important. But sometimes the path to democracy is not a straight path, as we saw, for instance, in a homogeneous country like Tunisia or Egypt, that when democracy challenges governments that have fossilized over a long period of time and an unjust relationship of power within their societies, that injustice also has to be worked out. So and sometimes that if there is not a very easy path for working that out, for instance, as South Africa did through a rather peaceful transition from minority to majority rule, you might go through a period of conflict like we saw in Iraq before things settled down. But the reality is that in most of the Middle East, you have very divided societies in which you don't have a homogeneous population. There is divisions not just by tribe, but also by sect and ethnicity. And dictatorships have not have protected certain imbalances. So, you know, the message of the youth is important, but what we have to understand is that there are hurdles in the road because of the nature of society and dictatorship in the Middle East, and therefore we have to watch for these and try to help this region get through this initial phase of settling these imbalances, so then it would have a clear run room to establish democracy and a much more just society.
I thank you for joining us here today, Vali Nasser.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Vali Nasser, who's a professor of international politics at Tufts University. His books include The Rise of Islamic Capitalism, Forces of Fortune, The Rise of the New Muslim Middle Class and What It Will Mean for Our World, The Shia Revival and Democracy in Iran. Between 2009 and 2011, he served in the Obama administration as senior advisor to the special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. We're going to take a brief station break now, and we'll be back with Adele Stan giving us five reasons progressives should treat Ron Paul with extreme caution.